I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In less than a month, Kansas City voters will be narrowing their choices for mayor from 11 to just 2. Quentin Lucas wants to convert his 4 years on the city council into becoming the city's next leader. Today, a conversation with candidate Lucas. We'll talk with him about his upbringing in Kansas City, moving development outside the downtown corridor, and reversing the effects of climate change. Then, pursuing a second career is not as uncommon as you might think. Layoffs, buyouts, and job dissatisfaction have people looking for something else. We'll ask a career expert about ways to find your next profession. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. In under 3 weeks from now, Kansas City voters will narrow the field of candidates for mayor from an outsized 11 to just 2. Among the candidates thought to be in the hunt for one of those two finalist slots is Councilman Quentin Lucas, who's taken a lead role on reducing developer incentives, limiting the city manager's power to issue contracts without council oversight, and renaming the Paseo after Martin Luther King Jr. Councilman Quentin Lucas joins me now here in the studio. Welcome back. So good to have you here.
Good morning, Steve. Happy to be back.
I love this line in the profile that Melinda Henneberger at The Star wrote about you, Quentin. She pointed out that since you were 10 years old, you've been called the little professor. I gather because you've always been so well-spoken. How did you feel about that nickname growing up?
You know, like many kids, I'm not sure I loved it. I thought it made me seem far nerdier than I was because I saw myself as a very cool athlete who was one day going to play in the Super Bowl or something.
Yeah.
You learn very quickly that maybe the professor was something that was far more fitting for me.
Yeah. You were homeless at times as a child. What do you recall from that experience?
You know, I think I recall how important some of the daily challenges, some of the daily issues you deal with are. When you don't have money and don't know where food is coming from, then the $5 that your mom had made a world of difference. The bus route actually coming on time or making sure you didn't miss it was key. And so those are experiences that will never leave me. And frankly, it also, since I've been on the council, has led me to always think about how we really need to solve problems, not talk about a generation from now solution, instead think about how issues are impacting people today.
You know, Melinda wrote there were times when you were growing up that your own piggy bank was what was saving the family in some ways.
You
know, did it get that dire?
Well, yeah, that's absolutely right. And it's because my mother, she worked her tail off every day. But as you could see fairly quickly, there wasn't always money saved to do even some of the basics things. And it was stressful for her. It was something that was painful. But I always wanted to chip in, and I respected the work that she was doing and thought I could do a little work as well to make sure the family was surviving all right.
How stressful was it on you as a little boy?
You know, when I was a child, I think I didn't recognize how stressful it was.
Yeah.
I think the older I've gotten, a number of different issues, I think I've realized some of the challenge that I dealt with. You know, in that same profile, you see that while I was homeless, I was also going to a very good prep school out in South Kansas City, Barstow. And the code switching, frankly, that I had to do from fully black family life and community life to a school with a bunch of whites, and many of whom of means, was something that was always a bit emotionally trying.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all those issues combined to make me stronger today, but certainly created a world of challenge.
How did you get into Barstow as a poor kid?
You know, I still remember it to this day. I went to get enrolled in the Kansas City, Missouri School District. And at the time, that was one of the years that enrollment was just awful and computers went down, everything like that. This is circa 1992.
Right.
And my mother, after I went through about a day and a half of waiting at KCMSD, said, I don't think the Kansas City School District is right for you. My two older sisters went, but I went out to Barstow for an interview. And I still remember when I went out there, I saw students my age that were performing in some shape Shakespeare-type class, which I found fascinating. But I went and observed. They did a test for me, and I think if I could say honestly now, we were a perfect match at the time because they had almost no black students, and my family had no money. And so I think the two combined to recognize we could get something out of each other, and that started my 10-year experience there.
Now, you mentioned code switching a few minutes ago, but what was it like? What was that switcheroo like for you going from the east side of Kansas City to Barstow every day?
You know, I think it was challenging for a number of years, and the way I dealt with it probably wasn't the healthiest. I still remember when I started at school, I still, for lack of a better term, kind of talk more like black folks, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember being a third or fourth grader who thought that I didn't sound proper, and so tried my best to work the ain'ts out of my speech and some of the other kind of phraseology that I had, which when I think about it now, kind of breaks my heart.
Breaks your heart because?
Because I feel like I thought I needed to lose some part of my identity and my character to succeed, which I think, as I've seen later in life, was inaccurate. I think that for a number of years, and frankly, this is how I think we saw things more of in the 90s, that to make it, you had to try to be more like others instead of having that appreciation in your own diversity and your own background. Mm-hmm. I think we've made great strides over the last 25 years in recognizing that, but, you know, that was how my experience started. One of the saving graces of that experience, though, was that, of course, as the years went on, I got to see that my peers of means and white folks and folks from the suburbs had many of the same challenges and issues that my family had, sometimes more. And it has helped me since I've been in public service and in law to see that many of us share a number of different problems and a number of other issues that we find to be important.
You know, just looking at the trajectory of your career and going off to Cornell after you graduated from high school, I can't help but think that the Barstow experience, with all its good and its challenges, it changed your life.
It did. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd be lying to you if I didn't say so. And I mean, I think the world of my sisters, who are two single women raising children of their own. My oldest sister has six. The other has two. Mm-hmm. Both graduates of the Kansas City schools. Both went on to college, but had a much more challenging experience than I did and have continued to have a much more challenging experience. Mm-hmm. The thing I always say about Barstow, and the thing that, frankly, I want for education for every child in Kansas City, is that I got to be selfish. I got to be this kid who could think about, if I wanted to study Latin, if I wanted to travel one day, if I wanted to be anything under the sun, what it helped me break from was that sort of, I need to survive and take care of my mother and my entire family and all those others. Whereas my sisters and I recognize it didn't have that opportunity. Mm-hmm. They were the older ones in the family and they were taking care of me. And now they're taking care of lots of children. And there are a lot of people that don't have the luxury of that top education where you can kind of think about yourself and where you want to be 20 years from now.
Councilman Quentin Lucas is my guest. He's a candidate for mayor of Kansas City. So why the law? Why'd you go into law?
Very simply, Thurgood Marshall, so many others, I thought lawyers were great people. I thought they made this monumental change in the trajectory of our society. Yeah. And I think when you look at particularly black history and black society, some of our greatest folks were lawyers. And so I always thought from the start that law was this great, noble profession and one where you saw a lot of people that were great change makers ultimately in society. And I'd be lying to you if I didn't say I also thought I'd be able to take care of my family. Hmm. You know, when you grow up poor and you know what it's like to have a car breakdown or being homeless, you are certain that you will never have that happen to you again. Mm-hmm. And I thought I'd at least have that security and connection with that.
You know, 4 years ago, you ran for the city council here in Kansas City. Why? What was your interest there?
I'd always loved and been interested in public service. I've been reading your columns my whole life, just about.
As you should have been.
Right.
Yeah.
It helps every child's reading. And I thought that, you know, I want to not just be the guy who reads the paper or watches the news or listens to the radio and complains. I want to be part of the solution. And I, at that point, had volunteered at a number of organizations, had donated to a few campaigns, including Mayor James's. But I thought I could have more impact. And I lived in a district where I thought, frankly, there was no reason why somebody nicknamed the professor, you know, shouldn't be an elected official there. I thought that I could be a strong leader there. I thought I could make the East Side and the 3rd District's voice ring out even louder at City Hall, and that's what got me into the race.
You know, you could have waited to serve 2 full terms in the council before going off and running for mayor, but you're doing it after 1 term. Why? Why not wait?
I think this is an important time about how we can set the agenda for the future of Kansas City. Mm-hmm. Mayor James, I think, has been very clear and very bold in agenda setting and what we're going to do in Kansas City. I think the next big step is, how do we set an agenda that looks to help poor people? How do we set an agenda that is a truly progressive one? I'm the youngest candidate running, actually, so I certainly want Kansas City to look great 20, 30 years from now. But I also recognize that when we talk about things like trickle-down economic development, or when we've seen our focus on housing be more about how do we find $10 million to demolish homes as opposed to rehabbing homes and rebuilding communities, I thought it was key for me to be a voice in this conversation. And you listed a few of the issues I've been involved in. Frankly, I have been a part of every tough public policy conversation in this city over the last 4 years. I've been proud of the focus that I've had, and I think that led me to believe that I would be a stronger and more helpful voice for Kansas City in the mayor's office rather than 3rd District at large for a second term.
You know, what does rehabilitating the East Side look like to you? What steps do we have to take?
It means real policy. And I say this as a critique on what I've seen much of my life. You know, a lot of people like to say the East Side problem is that there's not enough money there, that we don't throw enough government money there. And I don't think that's the case at all. Since I was a child, we've seen these kind of white elephant structures and projects that come up on the East Side. Dating back to the Berkeley administration, I even remember that there were things that sometimes happened. Too often those things were kind of so-and-so council member's accomplishment, and we didn't really talk about how that actually helps the whole area. And so when I talk about how to help the East Side, what I'm really talking about is how to help poor people almost anywhere in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. How are we impactful with policies? Let's use the 8-cent sales tax, for example, that was passed just for inner city economic development. I think the question and the fair critique you could have right now is, well, how is that money being spent aligned with real plan priorities? How are we doing things like funding more affordable housing there? How are we creating better walkability and density in neighborhoods? What we can't do is kind of have leapfrog development and these one-off projects. So we all say Lynnwood Shopping Center, which is a good project, but say that's great. And 18th and Vine is great. But we're not talking about how we're really rebuilding the community. So I think intentionality, how we do it there. And I think, frankly, tying every dollar that's going into, quote, East Side development into a real systematic plan for what we're trying to do, for how we're getting back housing, for how we're getting back jobs is key. And my final point on that is it can't be pandering. You know, we can't just have an East Side ribbon cutting once a year and say that we've done some great thing.
Yeah.
Instead, it needs to link to the whole ecosystem of development in East Kansas City.
You know, you say it doesn't come to dollars, but, you know, even if you were to take that money, the East Side 1/8-cent sales tax, roughly $100 million over a decade, if you took all that money and put it into one area, affordable housing, you all in the council have talked about a $75 million trust fund for housing. That would consume almost all of that money going forward. So how do you begin to address a myriad range of issues with a finite set of dollars?
Yeah, I think you look at the core of the issues that affect everyone's life each day. Now, while there are many, I'm one who actually introduced an ordinance and got some strong blowback on making sure we're spending a percentage of that East Side economic development sales tax money on affordable housing each year. I know the life of housing insecurity. I've seen my sisters and their children deal with it, which is and frankly, our school districts deal with it every day, and not just Kansas City Public. Every school district, particularly south of the river, but also North Kansas City I've talked to about, deal with students that are moving around all the time. What that creates for them is lesser economic opportunity, more challenges long term, et cetera. So I really would say that I think when we are thinking about what to do with the $94 million remaining on that East Side economic development pot, the idea is, what is it we're trying to look back and accomplish at the end? Do we want a one-off family dollar that's on a street corner somewhere, like at 18th and Prospect? The answer to me is no. My bigger answer is, would it be better if we have 3,000 more residents with stable housing? 3,000 more residents that are producers in Kansas City and that are able to leverage other developments like Prospect Max, like a number of the other entities that we're invested in right now in Kansas City, and really try to build from there. You know, sometimes we're almost paralyzed by the breadth of the challenge in Kansas City. I think we do need to identify a few key issues like affordable housing and really try to hit them from there.
You know, you do get a sense that the conversation in Kansas City has changed the last couple of years from all things downtown to looking more to the east and seeing what we can do there. That's a fairly profound change, isn't it?
It is a drastic change from when I joined the city council. I mean, I'll tell you the story of incentive reform when I, along with several others on the council and in our community, thought that we were really spending too much on TIFs and unnecessary tax breaks. How could we at least start to get more east side development? A lot of the pushback from the development community when I introduced that was, you're going to destroy all the progress we've seen downtown on the plaza and in the crossroads. And my view was fairly clearly that we have done a lot and that things are working, right? Mm-hmm. That train's moving and it's chugging along. And frankly, we need to help this city do more out east. And so I think we've seen good public policy from some of us on the elected official side. I think we've seen advocacy groups. I think we've seen success of the Kansas City Public Schools District over the last several years, which I think has people saying, yeah, we should stop diversions away from their tax base. And I think there's this one other thing. In lots of other American cities, Baltimore, St. Louis, Cleveland, et cetera, we've seen what the long-term concern is when you're not investing in your urban core and in your inner city. No matter how many big things they've built, Baltimore's got a wonderful inner harbor and a wonderful downtown and a downtown baseball park and a great airport. What it doesn't have is safety. What it doesn't have is communities that are growing. I don't want us to look like Baltimore. I think Kansas City needs to address that, and we're the wiser for addressing that now.
Again, Councilman Quentin Lucas is my guest. He's running for mayor of Kansas City. Dan from South Kansas City wrote in to ask this councilman, how can we get the streetcar to run east-west instead of just north-south?
Music to my ears.
We tried that once.
Yeah, music to my ears, that question. I mean, I think the biggest challenge we have in public transportation, including MAX lines, MAX bus lines, is that we are not doing east-west linkages. The city lives and thrives on this north-south division, and I think it's a tragedy for us. I'll give this example. So, you know, a lot of people say, and the mayor would be one to say this, we tried east-west before and it was voted down. Which is true. But this city in many other situations has had things voted down. I give you the stadiums as an example. In 2004, we tried a bi-state to improve Arrowhead and Kauffman. That failed. 2006, we tried a brand new issue because we thought it was so imperative that the Chiefs and the Royals are here for another 25 years. I think it is time for us to consider, through a citywide basis, frankly, how can we float some sort of initiative, be it taxing or reallocation of resources, to look to a real east-west route. 47th Street, Emmanuel Cleaver II Boulevard provides one area. I think 39th Street is another very dense corridor where if you invested in 71 Highway, let's say, or even Prospect, over to the state line in KU Hospital, you would see real dividends and real benefits.
That's
so that would be one of the first key things that I would look to. Before we look to jump the river, and I understand that that's a division two, but it's an expensive one to jump, I think why not look at these dense areas, the 39th Street corridor, maybe the 18th Street corridor, et cetera.
You know, Councilman, one of the big issues, as you well know, is violent crime in this community. What is Kansas City doing that's not working when it comes to violent crime?
You know, I think the first thing is we've let ourselves get too used to it. You know, we in too many situations, we were talking about my years at Barstow. So I read the newspaper every day. And I remember circa 1992 or 93 when I was a good deal younger, but reading about Kansas City breaking a homicide record for that year of 153. It breaks my heart that some 25 years later, we got close to doing the same thing.
Yeah.
I think step one is we need to realize the magnitude of the problem and how it affects our entire community. But what does that mean next? I agree that investing in a public health approach, mental health, trauma treatment is going to be key. And frankly, trauma in our communities. How do you address areas that have too much violence? But the other thing I think, and when you say public health approach, not enough people think about the role of intervention. Intervention relates both to policing. You hear this buzzword a lot, community policing, which means nothing unless you break it down. To me, what that means is a greater neighborhood presence from police. Now, here's where
we've talked about that in this town for a long time.
Yeah. You know, and And we're not doing it. Every few years, there's a story about we're going to have more officers walk in the beat, or we're going to have more bicycle cops, or something of that sort. What we need is a structural change from what I think American policing has even gone to, which is drive people around, and then if there's a big incident, an Operation 100, then you have every squad car available come show up, and it's almost like an armada that's coming to intervene. What I think we need to see, and God bless the young woman and her family who lost her life at Central High School recently, we need more presence from, I think, law enforcement in our schools in a positive way, in that community interaction officer sort of way. I think we need them at more neighborhood events, and frankly, KCPD does that.
Because there's no trust between the department, or not enough trust between the department and the citizenry it serves.
Right. I think there continues to be that lack of trust. And then I think in the funding priority, and I am one who supports local control, although I think we need to work on it long term. But one reason I do is for accountability, and another one is this, that if you look at the KCPD budget, the administrative bureau cost is eerily close to the patrol bureau. The patrol bureau are those people that you and I see out every day doing all types of things, writing tickets, intervening, investigating, and all that sort of stuff. The administrative bureau, as you know, is a lot of people downtown. I would love to see an allocation and a greater focus on how we have folks that are in the neighborhoods that are working with them and that become better known. And I think through that, you start to see more of a friendly approach. And I'll just say this, you know, I'm from the black community, grew up in it, have lived in it for, except for my 3 years in Ithaca, New York for school. And, I think it's not so much that people say we don't want the police. It's that we want the police in a positive environment, in a friendly way. Mm-hmm. You don't want harassment. You don't want over-enforcement. But what you do want is to know that they're there, and you want that deterrence. And I think that could help Kansas City long term, as long as we're also investing in our public health and education approaches.
So this emerging issue in the race, this idea of should the department be controlled locally or continue state control, as you know, Kansas City, the only major city police department in the country with a state-run police department, but you'd like to see it come back.
I'd like to see it come back, and I say this with respect to the police department, and I think we will talk to them, too, at length. I'd like to talk to the rank and file of the police department to know how we can do this effectively and efficiently, because in St. Louis, it really hasn't rolled out that well.
Right.
But that being said, I think fundamentally, right now, if everybody listening to this show hates our response to potholes, they can say, I'm going to hold Quentin Lucas to account, or Catherine Shields and Teresa Lohr and all these other people and Jolie. But if they hate what we're doing in terms of violent crime, then everybody kind of shrugs their shoulders and says, well, you know, we can try to work on things around the edges.
Yeah.
I think it is fundamental that public safety needs to be something that the public has more of a voice in. And I think the clearest way we do that is through greater accountability, through local control long term. And that is something that I would push for in my term.
Councilman Quentin Lucas is my guest. What can Kansas City do to combat climate change that could be recreated in, you know, in cities across the country?
Step one is to do less harm. And what do I mean by that? We continue to, and it's funny because we tend to mock sometimes our suburban friends and neighbors, but then we support the same leapfrog development that is fairly spread out, that requires us to build up a road infrastructure that is in many ways unsustainable for the tax base as well.
Mm-hmm.
So my step one would be, and I mean this with love to my friends in the Northland and parts of South Kansas City, frankly, how do we create more walkable, dense developments? And so I would like to see us in our planning and zoning policy really encourage more, frankly, Zona Rosa type developments where at least you have greater walkability in the area as opposed to spread out shopping centers. And I think another key part of that is how do we create more developments in the core of Kansas City, Missouri? I'd like to see with every incentivized project us move away from parking requirements. I have an ordinance right now relating to housing that frankly looks to abolish a lot of parking requirements in a number of areas to encourage that greater density from developers, particularly on bus rapid transit lines.
Yeah.
I think more than kind of energy-saving buildings, although those are important, the way that we can just stop the spread in our Kansas City, the sprawl in our city, is going to be helpful.
Grab those headphones, Quentin. We're going to put on a caller on the line here, Vince from Waldo. Vince, you're on Up to Date.
Thank you for taking my call. I think one thing we talk about violence growing up, I'm going to date myself in the 80s. We used to have summer youth programs where you had youth that were employed. And a lot of times, that's where a lot of kids were able to buy cars. They would spend money in the community. And then you have an economic system that's developed by the youth, but also they're spending money, they're being employed. I know that's going to cost more money, But with the added sales tax, could nothing had been said, hey, we're going to do a mass youth employment, summer youth employment. That would help tremendously in reducing crime during those summer months where it goes up.
Yeah, thanks, Vince. What about summer employment?
You know, I think he hits the nail on the head. During particularly Mayor Cleaver's administration, there was this great investment, both in summer employment, but also in the Mayor's Night Hoops program. The pure, let's create more activities and opportunities for kids, and my sisters talk to me about them to this day. I think the few things that we can do, yes, we have Hire KC Youth now. It's one where we're asking for a lot of kind of volunteer businesses to be part of that. I would like the business community to step up even further in that, and the same with the same fervor that they email and call my office about voting the right way on every airport project issue. I'd love to see that as a focus. I also think City Hall could do a much better job in creating more opportunities, particularly in the Parks and Rec Department, with youth every day. And frankly, we need to support the institutions that do hire a lot of youth. That includes the zoo, that includes Worlds of Fun and others. So I agree wholeheartedly with the caller, and I think we can do that.
Just a couple of final points. The mayor is proposing this 3-8-cent sales tax for early childhood education. It'll be on the same ballot that you'll be on for the mayor's primary on April 2nd. How are you going to vote on that thing?
You know, I'll be voting no. And the clear reason is because every public school district in Kansas City, Missouri opposes it. I think at a time when we're figuring out public education, when the school district is doing its best, probably in a generation, I do not think that we should work without them, work outside of them, and not come with a collaborative approach. I also think that if you remember court order DSEG in this city, just throwing money at an issue without figuring out how it works to help the poorest children, many particularly poor black children, then I'm not sure we've had a good plan. So this is not the right way to do pre-K, although I certainly care about the issue and think we can do better.
What kind of job has Mayor Sly James done during his 8 years in office?
You know, I think Sly has done an outstanding job being a great representative of this city, and he's done a fine job having a vision. There have been times that our visions have departed. And I think that what we need to do stronger is look to basic core quality of life issues in Kansas City, particularly for the poorest Kansas Cityans. I think if you talk to somebody in the 3rd District today at 36th and Jackson, where I was earlier, they don't think the last 8 years have been an improvement necessarily for them. I'd like to make sure that we see more of that while also seeing that our city can boom. I don't think it's an either-or proposition. I think we just need to do a heck of a lot more for our poorest in Kansas City.
Okay, that's Councilman Quentin Lucas. He's on the ballot for Kansas City Mayor on April 2nd, one of 11 candidates. Councilman, always great to have you here. Stay safe out in the trail, okay?
Thank you, Steve. Hope to be with you after April.
Sounds good. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about navigating second careers, how to get one, how to line one up. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, working across party lines hasn't been easy for Kansas Governor Laura Kelly. We talk with political reporters about her uneasy relationship with conservative lawmakers. Hear that and other previous episodes at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, history has sometimes underplayed the political power that women once wielded. We'll learn about a time when they ruled the world and ask what we modern humans can learn from an ancient civilization. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, lots of people find themselves looking for a second career at some point during their work lives. But once you've been out of the job market for a few years, you know, getting back into job hunting mode can be tough. One big reason, what employers are looking for in prospective workers can change over time. How resumes and cover letters should look also change. Now a conversation about the many reasons people end up looking for a second career and how to go about doing it. With us, Karen Sillins is the founder of A-Plus Career and Resume. She's helped more than 1,000 clients find their next job or career. Karen, nice to have you. Welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you.
How common is it for people these days to seek second careers? What do we know about that right now?
It's very common.
Yeah.
We ask 18-year-olds to make a decision about what they're going to do with the rest of their lives.
And don't tell me they get it wrong sometimes.
They get it wrong a lot of times.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's unfortunate because they have only a knowledge of, say, maybe 40, 50 careers that are out there when there's about 12,000, about 300 of those are typical careers. So they get into a career when they get out of school and they find they're dissatisfied.
Hmm.
It's not what they thought it would be.
And so they have to go back and look again.
Yes.
Well, who are the most common workers out there that tend to seek a second career at some point in their working lives?
A lot of medical and teaching professionals will seek a second career.
Yeah.
Now, medical professionals usually stay within medicine in some way, shape, or form.
Or some other aspect of it.
Another aspect. Usually these are like floor nurses and physicians that have been on their feet all the time, and they like to go to a more desk-oriented type job or something that doesn't have them on their feet constantly.
And teachers, you know, we all know about teachers who work 4 or 5 years and they don't find teaching what they thought it was going to be.
Exactly. And so I have two different sets of teachers that come to me. One is the one that has been working for 20 or 25 years, and now they want to do something different. And then I have the ones that they started out, and it's somewhere usually between that 3 to 8 year period, and they don't want to do it anymore.
Huh. Are teachers hard to find second careers for?
No. Actually, most teachers have a plethora of skills that they can utilize in the job market. They just don't realize it. They need to target where they're going, and they also need to determine, are they willing to go back and get some education? Would they be willing to get maybe a second degree? Would they be willing to look at some professional development or certifications?
Right, right.
Those can be a lot shorter route to getting a new job. And then, of course, they can look at what they already have that's transferable.
You know, I think it's interesting what you just said, this idea that, you know, a lot of folks out there have skills they don't realize they have. And I think a lot of people, they get into their careers and they think the only thing I can do is roughly what I'm doing right now. And what I hear you saying is that often is not the case.
No, we're not single faceted. We can do lots of different things. We just don't realize it because we're looking from our own narrow view.
Yeah. How do you help people figure out what they can do?
Well,
what they're capable of.
There are several things that I do. First of all, I go through all of their career. And that starts the jobs they had in high school going forward, what they liked about it, what they didn't like about it, and the skills that they feel they gained in it. And you'll get this laundry list of skills that people just didn't realize that they have, and they've continued to use over their career.
Yeah. So when people ask you how similar to one's first career does a second career have to be, what I hear you saying is typically not very much necessarily.
Not necessarily, no.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes it does relate, but a lot of times it's totally different.
Do you have people sit down and do Myers-Briggs, the test to figure out what your interests are? Is that a common tool you use?
I use DISC. And so it has the occupational aspect as well as the personality and the behaviors-based aspect to it.
Yeah.
And yes, it does recommend specific jobs, not just your enterprising or social or mechanical. It actually recommends very specific jobs.
You know, what if you know you want to go back to work? Maybe you haven't been working or you have a job you don't like, but you want to go in a different direction from your first job, but you're not sure exactly what that might be. Again, so what are the different ways that you help people navigate that question?
Well, first of all, we find out what their interests are.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have interests that they can turn into a career, and they just don't realize it. And this isn't about necessarily being an entrepreneur, but they're very much strategic thinkers, for instance, and they don't realize that that can be a fine skill to use in corporate America, especially when it comes to things like project management.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so when you walk them through seeing what they could potentially do, you find out what their personality's like, if that kind of work would suit them. Do they already have some existing skills? And are they willing to potentially go get a certification in it or at least some training? They all of a sudden open up and realize, wow, there's something out there for me.
That's interesting. We're talking about the hunt for second careers in our economy these days. Our guest, Karen Sillins, the founder of A-Plus Career and Resume. If you want to join our conversation, the number here, 816-235-2888. We have a great expert here who can offer you some guidance here, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, for people, Karen, who haven't looked for a new job in a while, how scary can this be?
It's very scary. They've made the job search extremely difficult for people, and there's no reason for it. You know, Billie Jean King talks about on a program one time that aging isn't for sissies. Mm-hmm. Well, a job search is not for sissies either. It's a very, very difficult process. And people
Why is it so difficult?
Well,
remind me.
Several things. One, applicant tracking systems. When you apply online, you have to go through that applicant tracking system. So you have to have a resume that's more tailored towards that industry and that job type. And it's not just what's in that ad, because some ads are so generic as to be ridiculous. Some of those ads are looking for a unicorn, which doesn't exist. You have to hedge your bets and know the overall industry and that job type and the keywords and key phrases that apply to it. Then you get into three dating terms that are now being used in the job search. One is ghosting. Companies call you on the phone. They're really interested in you. And they say, we'll call you back next week and schedule an interview. You never hear from them again. Or the same thing with actually going in and interviewing with them. And then you never hear from them again. They can't even bother to call you back or email you and tell you that you're no longer in consideration. Then you have the catfishing. You go in, you think it's a job for marketing. It turns out they want you to be a commission-only salesperson. And then there's the benching.
You call it catfishing?
Catfishing, just like the
dating
term. I like
your terms, yeah.
And
yeah.
Lastly is benching. Benching is a term that's used in baseball, of course, as well. And it's when they're on the bench and they just keep showing you, oh, yeah, we're really interested in you. We can't wait to get you in the game. But they never quite get you in the game.
Well, I'm confused by that, because you think with the unemployment rate being as low as it is, that people who are seeking out workers would be on their best behavior these days, because the supply of workers supposedly is shrinking out there.
One would think so, but they're still operating as if it's 2009 in the middle of the recession, and they treat potential employees in a terrible manner. They don't even onboard them properly once they get them in the company. You know, they forget that they're marketing. They forget that they do their marketing from the beginning of that relationship, which is when the people see the ad or hear about the job, all the way through to while they're working for the company.
Huh. And if you could rule the world, it sounds like you would change that behavior pretty quickly.
Very much so.
Yeah. Can people who are searching for a job, can you ever sort of challenge the way they're being treated? Or is that just an automatic red flag that's going to get you booted out of any prospect of getting a job?
It's an automatic red flag, unfortunately. Yeah. And unless they're asking you maybe what could be considered a quasi-illegal question or something, where you could come up and ask them back, well, what do you ask that for? Mm-hmm. That's less challenging, obviously, than saying, well, that's illegal. You can't ask me that question.
Yeah, right. Okay, our number here, 816-235-2888. We're talking about the hunt for second careers. Let's go to Frank from Lawrence. Frank, you're on Up to Date.
Hi. Yeah, my situation, I have worked in Africa for 8 years, beginning with Peace Corps and then development work, and then six years in the Middle East after I had my master's in teaching English as a second language. I am 75 years old here in Lawrence, Kansas. I have been doing temporary work answering phones. I can't really find work teaching English. They aren't hiring right now at KU. What do you think?
What other interests do you have? What other things have you thought about doing outside of teaching English?
Well, the only things available here seem to be these helping older people in their households, different things here in Lawrence that are not teaching English. I have had some people sending me work to edit their documents to earn some money, but not a whole lot.
What are your interests, Frank?
Teaching English as a second language.
Okay.
I guess aside from that, I'm not sure what it would be.
So that's where you get into the situation of, if you can't find a job in what you're looking for, then you have to see if you can find something that relates to it, like copy editing for a company. You know, it may be part-time work, it may be full-time work, and it may mean that you have to go outside of Lawrence. It may mean that you have to go over towards the Kansas City area. That doesn't mean you necessarily have to come into downtown KC, but you may have to come over to Shawnee.
I have done some of that work with when they're doing job fairs here, but I think my age of 75, soon to be 76, is keeping me out of the workforce.
I was just going to say, let's just ask the obvious question here. How challenging is it for older workers like Frank to land positions? I'm thinking of some of my former colleagues at the Star who are all over 55 years old, and those are tough ages.
Well, and part of it is they see you as somebody who isn't going to stay long term, and yet companies aren't the least bit devoted to keeping you long term.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rather ironic situation. They want you to be loyal to them, but they don't want to be loyal to you. And what I tell people is never allow the age to be an issue for you. First of all, don't go back and visit the 80s or really that much of the 90s, if you will, on your resume anymore. Go for the last 15 or so years and stick with that. That is going to get you enough information on there. And you can always have an additional experience section where you put mm-hmm. some of those additional skills. But let's face it, companies are always going to be worried about what have you done for me lately.
Yeah. Well, what are some other good things for older folks to think about who want to get going here? Ways to respond to the obvious question that's going to be in the minds of prospective employers, which is, does this person still have the energy and the drive to do the work that we're going to need here?
Well, first of all, show up with that energy.
Mm-hmm.
Show up dressed like you need to be dressed. Show up with that big smile on your face and shaking their hand and looking like you're an energetic person. And secondly, make sure that they understand you have no intention of retiring anytime soon.
Hmm. Just be real upfront about it.
Be upfront.
Yeah. Is it fair to say that older folks have greater challenges than someone in their mid-40s?
Usually once you hit about 65, it starts to become a lot more of a challenge.
65? How about 55?
Not as much.
Really?
You know, plenty of my clients that are 55 don't have a problem getting a job.
Yeah. How do you determine, you know, these reasons that people change careers, Karen? What have you learned about over the years about why people are doing that? What else have you learned?
So one of the reasons people will change careers is, of course, as we talked about earlier, the dissatisfaction. Two, then there's, I've been doing this for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just done doing this. I want to do something different. And sometimes it's related and sometimes it's not. But then you also have the people who they think that they're unhappy in their job. What they're really unhappy with is their boss or the company or a portion of the work that they're doing that they really do not care for.
Mm-hmm.
And what they need to observe first is, where am I really dissatisfied? Is it everything that I'm doing essentially in this job overall I just do not like and do not want to do anymore and every day I dread going in? Or is it the coworkers? Is it the boss? Is it the company? Because sometimes people are really dissatisfied there and it's not their actual career.
So thinking clearly about what's on the table in front of you is something that's pretty important then.
Yes.
Yeah. We're talking about the search for second careers. So let's talk about common mistakes that people make, Karen, and start with the idea of people. I'm guessing that a lot of people overestimate their abilities and the type of job they're qualified to get. How common is that?
It's actually more common with men than with women.
Oh, color me not shocked. Yeah, yeah.
They did a big study that was, probably about 5-6 years ago that was in the Wall Street Journal. And they said for men, if they've got 50-60% of what they want, they'll just go and apply for the job. And women a lot of times think they have to have 100% or they won't apply for the job.
Oh, that's interesting.
And what you really are looking for is that sweet spot, 80 to 90% of what they're looking for, because if you know everything, they're going to consider you overqualified.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, you're not going to learn a darn thing when you start that job. But if you only have, say, 50% of it, then you're just not qualified. You're missing a whole lot of what they need in that career.
How do you coach people through that? Because you're getting the tender male ego on the line here pretty quickly. How do you navigate that?
I bridge the consultancy and coaching role. So I will say to them, let's take a look at these different requirements. And then we'll talk about the realism of them actually being able to utilize that. We don't have this skill, we don't have this skill, we don't have this skill. When you walk it through in a logical manner, as opposed to the emotional, this sounds like a really cool job, I just want to apply. They tend to go, that's probably good. I didn't try to do that job.
How about the mistakes that people tend to make with resumes? You've already mentioned one, older folks maybe going back too far in their careers. What else would you point to?
The one-page myth that's out there. Oh, you should only have a one-page resume.
That's what I always thought.
Well, and that's a college rule. Mm-hmm. When you're coming out of college, a good portion of college students, not all, but a good portion of them will have a one-page resume because they have limited or no work experience. So the only experience they really have is maybe their involvement in organizations that are on campus. That's going to limit it to that one page. What happens to, unfortunately, a lot of graduates who are non-traditional students mm-hmm. who go back 10, 20, 30 years later is they're told the same thing, and that's a huge mistake. They're ignoring their entire work life and all of those things that bring them to that point. And so they can still go back that 10 or 15 years and showcase the transferable things and the places where they've had success. Most people have a 2 or 3 page resume. In order to get past those scanning systems, you know, executives can get away with more. You know, they can sometimes do a 1 page and then have a 4 pager, depending upon who's reading it. But the average job seeker's got to get past that scanning system.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to get past the scanning system, you have to have enough information in it to showcase that you're the person that has all those skills. Then once you get past it, you have somebody taking that 15-second look at it. And they have to go, yes, I can see a relationship here and where they mm-hmm. can potentially be a good hire for us. Now it's on to the hiring manager to take a look at it, who's going to say, these are the 10 or 15 people I want you to call. So now they're actually reading them and they're going, okay, they said they have this particular skill. I can see in this recent bullet point in their resume or someplace in their resume where they actually have that particular mm-hmm. skill and have used it successfully in the workplace.
How about mistakes, Karen, with cover letters? What have you noticed when it comes to navigating that part of the search?
People will use those templates that say, hi, I saw your job on Career Builder and thought I'd apply, and I think I'm a good match. And they keep it so short as to be ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't mean you have to have a page-long cover letter. I usually write one that's fairly lengthy, but I have a bunch of bullet points in the middle, so that really shortens it up significantly mm-hmm. in the reader's mind. Mm-hmm. But the average job seeker needs to be careful of a couple things. Number one, every sentence does not need to start with the word I or my. Mm-hmm. You need to be a little bit more
creative than that. Yeah, right.
Secondly, is to make sure that it conveys those other types of skills that you often can't delineate within the context of a resume in how you communicate with people and all of that. Because this is a marketing letter. It's no different than a business letter you're writing to a company. You're marketing yourself to them.
What about this idea that people seek second careers based on what their close friends and families tell them they should do?
Oh, yes. I call that the committee of they. They
yes.
mean well, but they don't know what they're talking about. And they'll say, you should try sales because you're such a friendly person. But they don't consider the fact that this person can't take doing cold calling and going door to door all the time and all of this stuff.
Let's go to Mara from Lee's Summit. Mara, you're on the air.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks, Mara. Go quickly if you would. I'm getting a little short of time.
Okay, great. I'm 50 years old, and I'm in my senior year at UCM for social work. I've been an esthetician in spas for 17 years. So my question is, what would you suggest if someone has no background at all in what they're going into?
What's an esthetician?
I do facials, chemical peels,
microdermabrasion. Okay, I've not taken advantage of that. Yeah.
First of all, go Mules. I'm a UCM graduate, and so is my husband. That's where we met. But secondly, what is your major again?
I'm in my senior year of social work there.
Social work. Okay, so one of the number one things that you're going to do in social work is develop a relationship with people to help them. That is customer service, but it's on a higher level. That's what you do while somebody's sitting in your chair getting a facial for an hour.
That's a great point. We're going to have to leave our conversation there. Mara, good luck to you. Karen Sillins, founder of A-Plus Career and Resume, thanks for sharing your expertise with us. I sure appreciate it, Karen.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the show, explore with us an often overlooked time in history when women rule the world. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, who'd like women to rule the world again, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.